97.1 FM Talk Podcast. 97.1 FM Talk Podcast. This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. The Mark Reardon Show.
They call my plan Bidenomics. Guess what?
It's working.
I will say that there have been so many accomplishments under this administration, it can be difficult to list them in a distilled way.
I do not hate anyone. So I say this gently. The Biden administration sucks.
This is the Mark Reardon Show.
Well, I would rate that very true, I think, from Senator Kennedy. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, as we get rolling here on a Tuesday afternoon. Sue is on hold with Spire, and she may be that way the entire afternoon.
They said 1 minute.
Yeah, that doesn't work that way, right?
Oh, my gosh.
So she walks in. She's got the the Spire, you know, message going on speaker. But hopefully you'll get through. I think she got through. So she's done with this show. She's out of here. She's not going to deal with this. Fred, how are you this afternoon?
I'm good. How are you?
I don't know because I can't hear you. So here we go. Yeah.
Is this any better?
Yeah. I think it's better. And everything sounds different from yesterday, so I'm going to adjust. They warned me that it would be the case, and I apologize to the audience. There's just a lot of transition going on right now, and every time I sit down, it's just a little different, so I'm trying to get used to it. You got to hold a little baby this morning, didn't you?
Yeah, that was great. You know, Trisha, one of our executives here, brought her baby, Bernie, in for his first St. Louis Odyssey tour.
Yeah, Trisha Everding, who's basically, she runs this place, and she's been gone since, when was Bernie born? Do you remember? It was like early July, wasn't it?
Yeah, it had something like been that. And 3 months ago.
Yeah, that's a good little point of reference there. 3 months, Fred.
I would think.
Yeah, about that, right?
Right.
So Bernie was born 3 months ago, and she just brings him in for the first time 3 months later today. That's, and most of us weren't here. Sue wasn't here. I wasn't here. Trisha Everding. Fred was here. Nobody else was here.
Yeah, so I was here, and I think she said she wanted to wait until she could make sure that it would be a good trip for everyone involved.
All right, well, we'll see how that goes.
And I always liked holding, you know, Bernie. I was holding Bernie and walking around because I'm trying to nurture a future producer.
Is that what it is, Fred?
That's right. I start young.
Then you need to get him in here around me and see if he can take the abuse, because that would be something that would be required. Ethan's like shaking his head. Yes, up and down right now.
That's why they waited till a morning visit when you weren't here.
Boy, this does sound, I don't know how it sounds to the audience, but this is going to take some, it's different, right?
It is.
Okay, I don't like it. Just tell the engineers I don't like it, Ethan. Whatever they did, I don't like, all right? Because it sounds weird. All right, we're going to get going here, and I'm going to try to get the weirdness out of my head as we get rolling for a Tuesday afternoon. Charles Lipson's coming up here in just a few minutes. He is the professor emeritus at the University of Chicago, writes for The Spectator and Real Clear Politics and more. He's always a great political expert, so we'll get him on in the 3 o'clock hour. We've got a lot of stuff going on, including Governor Mike Parson. They're going to execute Marcellus Williams tonight, which I think is a good thing, and I'll address that in just a few minutes. But let me kind of get, we'll get into this with Charles here in a couple of minutes as well. But there is a little bit of polling whiplash that's going on right now. We addressed this yesterday, and I don't know. I did have, Fred, I asked you this morning, did you hear Zig last night in the 5 o'clock hour?
I did.
So he got a little, he was crabby, John Ziegler, right? But his point was, and let me see if I can kind of flesh this out just a little bit. We were talking about the polls. John is not very rosy on the opportunity for Trump to win this. And he felt that some of the polling, there's this site out there, I like it quite a bit, it's called Real Clear Politics. It started as a polling site in 2000, during the 2000 election. And what they've done from, you know, decade to decade is they've grown. They have Real Clear Markets and Real Clear Sports. They have different aspects. They might not have the sports. They might have spun that one and sold it off. But they have different aspects to the website. But on the politics website, you see, and if you would go there right now, you'd see a collection of articles. They load these up every day, Tuesday, September 24th. Just to give an example, the first piece is Jonathan Alter from Washington Monthly on Pennsylvania and how important that is for the presidential race. Then Paul Bedard from the DC Examiner talking about some other things related to polling. And then there's a few other people. So it goes back and forth, and you don't just get conservatives. You get both sides, if not more than both sides. But they also have their polling site. And if you go to the right-hand side of Real Clear Politics, they show you the polling from state to state, whether it's the battlegrounds, Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Wisconsin, on down the list. They show you where Trump is. Just to give you an example of that, Georgia right now, he sits slightly up, which is a good thing because we had some polling from Georgia last week, which didn't look good. He's up 2.1 in the average. In North Carolina, he's up 0.5. Narrow, but that's good. In Pennsylvania, Harris has a slight lead. And then you can kind of tick on down and go through the list. Now, where John was challenging me is they also have this feature on Real Clear every day now. And I kind of like it because I think it's fun to look at. And I'll explain why in a moment. And I'll explain what he was saying. So it's this day in history, September 24th. And they do this every day. They have the average of the polls. And when Real Clear does the polls, they have a list of, you know, whatever the polling group might be, they list it. I'll just go to the national polling right now, and I'll tell you where the polls are, which polls they are. So you have CNN, Quinnipiac, Reuters, CBS News, Morning Consult, Rasmussen, NBC News, Fox News, New York Times, Siena, all these. There's a bunch in here. And just to give an example, in the Rasmussen one, Trump is up. This is the national poll right now. Trump is up plus two. In the Atlas Intel poll, he's up plus three. In all of the other polls, he is not up. Quinnipiac has it tied right now. Reuters has Harris up plus six. That seems to be a bit of an outlier. CBS has Harris up 0.4. Keep in mind, even on the big spreads nationally, you're still looking at electoral votes. So right. It maybe doesn't mean as much. But anyway, they average that out, right? And then if you go to the page where they kind of break this down, it says this day in history, 2016, Hillary Clinton was up 3 points nationally in the average. Joe Biden was up 6.9. He had a big lead in 2020. And right now, Kamala Harris is up 2.1. If you go to the battleground states, so let's look at Wisconsin. Clinton was up 4.7 in 2016. Biden was up 6.6. Harris is up 1 point. So what John was criticizing, and this is where I don't agree with him completely, is he says, and I'm not making this assumption, he feels that some people are saying, look, in Pennsylvania, Clinton had a 5.6% lead. And in 2020, Biden had a 4.3%. Harris only has 0.6. So that means Trump's going to win. He feels like some people are saying that. I'm certainly not saying that. I'm just saying that the polling, and it's certainly changed since 2016, does look relatively favorable to Trump, certainly compared to all these other times. Now, I'm not a big person that believes in everyone taking these polls right now. I believe in polling, and I think there's some science still that's valid in election and other things, but I don't know who's actually taking the polling. I think some people are shying away, and they're not answering. How many people in this room? So you're getting the text messages, right? Fred,
oh,
are you getting text messages?
No, I'm not.
Okay, I don't know how I'm on the list, but I get a lot of text messages. And, you know, I've taken a couple of the polls, and lately I've just kind of, you know, sent them on their merry way, and I've just deleted it. But you know, I don't know how many people are taking polls, is my point. Are young people taking polls?
I don't. I get them, I put them in spam.
Right. Well, so that's what people say. People say, look, I don't believe in polling because, you know, landlines aren't being answered, which is true. But the pollsters have made some adjustments because this is what they do. And we'll get into this a little bit more with Mr. Lipson here in a few minutes. The bottom line is we still have a very, very close race. And there is increasing pressure on Kamala Harris to maybe say something about her campaign, which seemingly is not going to happen. So let me play you a couple of pieces of audio here from, you know, what they call a surrogate. A surrogate is out there who campaigns for the main candidate. It could be like when Trump was running in the past two cycles. They're not doing this as much. Maybe they are in the states that matter. But Laura Trump, for example, would be Donald Trump Jr. be a surrogate. I don't love surrogates. So someone will come on here. And if you can't get, I guess my policy, Fred, would be if we can't get the candidate, I don't necessarily want a surrogate. Right.
Right.
But Missouri, you can't really even play that game right now because we're not in, you know, in contention. Fred, you remember if you go back to 2012, hell, John McCain called my show. You know, I think it was live on one afternoon.
Did he really?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Whoa, that's wild.
Well, because if you go to, that would have been 2012. That would have been 2008, because Romney was 2012. Oh, yeah. Because you remember that Obama was going to steamroll him. And, you know, then the economy collapsed and he was going to get steamrolled even more. But they, you know, they were doing interviews because at that point, Missouri was still a purple state and it was in play. We don't get that now. But my point is the surrogates still go on nationally, which is funny because if I'm CBS News or Fox or anyone else, I say, hey, we ain't taking the surrogates unless you're going to give us the candidate. And Trump comes on and he does interviews. Kamala doesn't. Now, this first person, I don't know who this person is, but I think it's still kind of fun to listen to here. This is Sandra Smith, who is with Fox, and she's interviewing this person who wants to tell you all about Kamala Harris's policy and how great she is here, right?
What is Harris's plan? We're waiting.
Okay. There's a lot of aspects to it in regards to looking at it online. So let's talk about lowering the grocery cost, because that's something that's brought up. The viewers can look at this online. She talks about certain things in regards to advancing the first federal ban on price gouging on food and groceries, mm-hmm. to set clear rules to the road to make it clear that big corporations can't unfairly exploit consumers as well.
Is that happening? Secure new authority. Is that happening?
Yeah, so she was at Sandra Smith saying, wait a second. She's what? Doing this, she's doing that, she's going to say price, you know, price gauging, as Kamala called it. But is that happening? So she kind of followed up on this here.
Could it not at this moment? No, this is her plan that's laid out for the first 100 days when she becomes president of the United States of America.
Gouging, is that currently happening?
No.
In regards to I don't know exactly if that's currently happening or not, because I'm not privy to that type of information.
She's the best they got at the Harris campaign. So
that's
she goes
awesome.
Out, hey, let's pick this person. And by the way, I looked for her name and I didn't see it on the scroll, but she's an idiot. We know that. So we'll just, you know, describe her as idiot A, who doesn't even know what Kamala Harris is all about, because she's torn a couple of pages from Biden's campaign and from the White House, and she slapped them up on a website, and that's good enough for the American people.
But there are people are costing a lot of money in regards to groceries.
Okay, it seems like potentially you're having a hard time articulating her plan.
That's not true.
All right, so this is fun too, because Sanders says, hey, it kind of seems like you're struggling here articulating a plan. And then she goes and she pulls the victim card. She says, I know you're talking over me here.
I'm constantly being interrupted by you.
No, you weren't.
As a woman, I think
oh,
is...
Oh, the woman card.
Disrespectful. When I'm trying to speak, every time I try and speak,
you
speak over
yeah.
me.
Yeah. Look, I can play all that audio again. I'm not going to do that. But you will not hear Sandra Smith talking over her. She kind of asked the question a couple of times. Then there's Mark Cuban on MSNBC.
I appreciate you calling in, telling us what you're hearing on these fronts. That's great. But as you've said yourself, you can't speak for the vice president. These are things they're telling you. Who knows what they're telling right. other people? My guess is they're telling anybody who's donating to them exactly what they want to hear at this point. What matters is what they say publicly and what they will stick to.
No. Absolutely, positively not. Right. Let me just be very clear.
I don't know. Like, why do you think that they're telling you the truth and not telling other people other things?
Well, I don't,
if they look, won't say it publicly, say it publicly. Tell all of us so that we can hold you to it.
I get it, but you've got to get the details right. You can't just...
Yeah, but we have 60 days till an election. Like, you're asking people to take a flyer.
Even if it's the day before the election, right? Even if it's the day before.
What?
No. Are you insane?
That's what he said. Look, it doesn't matter. This is what Hillary Clinton said yesterday. It doesn't matter. You're just being sexist. It's a double standard. You're asking her to do interviews. What? No, we're asking a presidential candidate to do interviews.
Yes.
I don't care if she's a woman or if she's a man or if she's in between, which a lot of people seem to be there. But I love the fact that it doesn't matter. This is how much they hate Trump and they don't care about anything else. So this is another one of my favorite moments. So this is Brett Stevens with Stephanie Ruhle from MSNBC. Brett Stevens is from the New York Times, and he's not voting for Trump. He makes that very clear. But even Brett Stevens, this is on Bill Maher's show. Brett Stevens even tries to say, look, shouldn't we be able to ask her just a few questions? I don't know.
I'm a decided voter. I'm never going to vote for Trump, but I'm not sure I want to vote for Kamala. And my fear is that she doesn't really have a very good command of what she wants to do as president.
You think? Okay, that was good.
It'd be great for her to sit down with you or George Stephanopoulos or you, Stephanie, and get a succession
as
of...
As if she'd sit down
okay.
with me.
Why not?
Well, I had to get that in there. That's Bill saying no. She ain't going to sit down with me, right?
George W. Bush, 25 years ago, was asked if he could name the president of Pakistan and other people. He had no idea. And people said this guy has no command of foreign policy. And it turned out to be a prescient set of questions. It's not too much to ask Kamala, say, are you for a Palestinian state if Hamas is going to run that state?
Okay.
Yes or no?
Yeah, that seems to be a pretty big question right now. But she hasn't been asked that question. That wasn't anything that... You know, Dana Bash asked her.
Let's say you don't like her answer. Are you going to vote for Donald Trump?
No, I'm not.
Kamala
I just
Harris
said I'm not going to vote for her.
Is not running for perfect. She's running against Trump. We have two choices. And so there are some things you might not know her answer to. And in 2024, unlike 2016 for a lot of the American people, we know exactly what Trump will do, who he is, and the kind of threat he is to democracy.
I don't know.
He's a threat to democracy. That's Stephanie Ruhle. Now, listen to what she said there. It doesn't matter what Kamala Harris's answers are to anything. It is irrelevant. That's essentially what's, well, it's not even essentially, it is what she's saying. It's irrelevant when her answers are because the big orange man is a lot worse.
I don't know her answer to anything, okay?
But you know and his I think answer I, to everything.
That's, and that's why I would never vote for him, and people shouldn't vote for him. But people also are expected to have some idea of what the program is of the person you're supposed to vote for. You're just not supposed to say, well, you have to vote for Y because X is this, that, and the other. Let's find out a little bit more. And I don't think it's a lot to ask her to sit down for a real interview as opposed to a puff piece in which she describes like her feelings of growing up in Oakland with nice lawns.
Yeah. Is that too much? And that's the guy from the New York Times. Now, if pushed, I think Brett Stevens would admit, no, we don't really want her to do this because we don't want Trump in office. But I did think it was interesting that that debate was happening. And again, that was on Bill Maher's show. All right, we're going to take a break. We're coming back with much more this afternoon. We're off and rolling here on a Tuesday edition of the Mark Reardon Show. Sue Thomas, are you going to Back to the Future the musical tonight?
No, but it's only because I'm not on whatever list that is. I need
Damn it,
to call
we need
Julie.
To get you on that list,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I would love to see it.
I'm looking forward to it. I don't know much about the music portion. I was watching the trailer, and it seems like they used some of the Huey Lewis music. And we had Bob Gale in the studio.
He was so great.
He was great a week ago. He's the guy that, with Robert Zemeckis, created Back to the mm-hmm. Future. Just hearing him talk about, you know, thinking about, hey, what would my mom be like if,
yes,
you know, I went back when she was in high school, and that's how he and Zemeckis kind of put it together.
So cool.
And it's been immensely successful and then turned into a Broadway musical that is now coming to the Fox Theater. So we look forward to that. I'm taking a hot date, Alexa Reardon. Tonight, she's very excited because she watched the movie earlier this year.
Oh, that is really
fun. And she loved the movie. And that movie, for those of you who have kids in that age group or grandkids, it is a good one for sure. Charles Lipson is back with us right now, professor emeritus at the University of Chicago. It'd be fascinating to go back like 30, 40 years to when Lipson was in his prime. Not that you're not in your prime right now, Charles. I will say that. But how are you this afternoon?
Let me tell you, the one thing I am really glad about is that there were not video cameras readily available when I was in my college years.
Well, you know, because right now, if you're a college professor, look, the students are going to record you. If you're doing something that they don't like or they think they don't like, they're going to put the camera on you, right?
That is so true. But what really worried me was when I was a student. think about the things you did in college.
Oh, no, I don't want
to
think about those.
You were at Mizzou, right?
Yeah.
You were at Mizzou. Yeah. Pretending to major in journalism. And I was
yes.
I was pretending to major in political science, but I'm just glad there aren't videos.
No, I know. You know, it's funny. Along those lines, I went to the Mizzou football game over the weekend, and we were going through an area to get to the tailgate that was right past where the University Police Department is, which is separate from the Columbia, Missouri, or the Boone County Sheriff's Department. And I was instantly, Charles, brought back to the winter of 1984 when I was booked into that police department. I had my fingerprints taken, and they took a mugshot, and they took a mugshot on a Polaroid camera. And the first one, the cop screwed up, and he hands it to him, and he goes, ha, don't show this to your parents, or don't. I'm like, you. But that was for a possession of a product now that is legal in most states, including Missouri.
Well, see, I have a story like that. Do you have time?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I was at a drive-in, the Ranchero, known as the Ranch. By the way, the best drive-in around there was known as the Elkham Rind. And it was because they had a big sign that said, welcome, friend, but the W and the F had burned out.
Wait, where was this?
This was in northern Mississippi.
Okay, all right, in Mississippi.
Okay, so I was at the Ranch, not the Elkham Rind, and we had gotten some older kids. We had our dates, and we'd gotten some older kids to buy us some beer. Well, this turned out to be a bad idea, and even though we were sort of sitting plainly in the car. So we were taken down to the police station, and before my godfather came to bail us out, my high school, this was the next town, not my town.
Right.
My high school math teacher came to put in the good word for me and my friends.
Wasn't that nice?
The problem was he was drunk.
Oh no.
So I'm getting the word that I'm a great guy.
Oh, my. Yeah, and that's one that sticks with you in the memory bank for sure. Well, he tried. A for effort, I guess, is what we'd say on that
front. That's it. Okay, let's talk serious stuff.
Let me start, before we get to the election, let me start with Israel and Hezbollah and some of this stuff. Now, I will candidly tell you that I was out a couple of days last week, and I never really got to address the technology aspect of this, because, and I don't even know if I've wrapped my head around the technology around all this with the pagers and everything that happened last week. Is there a way to explain that?
You didn't answer my pager.
No, exactly. But what happened there?
Well, I think it's probably the most brilliant yeah. intelligence operation that's outside of a James Bond movie.
Yeah,
totally agree.
I mean, what they had to do was plan years in advance to intercept the supply line. And now what we think was done was that the Israelis actually took over a factory many years ago to produce the electronic devices that were used by Hezbollah. They sold to many other people, pretending to be a real company.
Right.
They licensed and everything. But their real customer, the one that they were really interested in, was Hezbollah. Well, what happened, and this is the politics of it, as well as the spycraft, on October the 7th, right, we're nearing a year, when Hamas in Gaza attacked the citizens of southern Israel, kidnapped them, and so forth. The next day, the Hezbollah, which is in Lebanon, the other side of Israel, is also, like Hamas, is also an Iranian proxy. Hezbollah decided, we're joining forces with Hamas, and we will start firing rockets into Israel, which they did. But the head of Hezbollah, a man named Nasrallah, still alive, said, but we think the Israelis have penetrated our cell phone network. So don't use cell phones anymore. Use pagers. So they ordered thousands of pagers for Hezbollah members. That's when the Israelis shipped them the pagers from, it appears, Hungary. It may be Romania, but it looks like it was Hungary. And they had put small amounts, very small amounts, of explosive in there so that it would kill the person with, and they put in software and so forth, firmware, that could trigger it. But it was a small amount of explosives, and that's important because they were only trying to kill the person who had the pager.
Right.
Now, if that person had a small child standing, his own daughter standing next to the pager, then so be it. But and a very sad thing it was. But the fact is they could have used three times as much and killed a lot of surrounding people. They made an effort not to do that.
It is amazing, and it's, you know, maybe at some point someone's going to do a big special on this, but it seems to be underexplained at
yes.
this point. And
yes.
when I heard about it last week, I was fascinated by it. I think a lot of people were, and it's really interesting because of all the planning that had to go into it. Now,
they didn't tell the Americans in advance.
Ooh, yeah.
They thought that they may have told the Americans, oh, we have we have something that we're going to do or something like that. But they thought it would leak from the Americans. They had experience with the Americans leaking things to our enemies.
Well, that's unfortunate. I wish that wasn't the case. But what does this then, at this juncture, then mean for the broader conflict? We keep talking about more of a ground invasion, which still hasn't happened. But what are your thoughts on where this is now headed since Hezbollah is more involved?
I would say that when you knock out all the communications, then the next thing you do is start going after all of their long-range missiles, which could hit Tel Aviv and could hit Haifa. They could also hit Jerusalem, but presumably a Muslim organization wouldn't want to do that lest they inadvertently hit a Muslim site. But when you start doing that, it's what you would do prior to a ground invasion. Now, remember, what the reason the Israelis are doing this is that some 60 to 70,000 people have had to move out of northern Israel because they were being bombarded day after day by Hezbollah missiles after October the 8th. And so that's what the immediate goal is.
And by the way, I think that's another undercovered aspect of this whole situation. The 60,000
well, right.
Israeli, yeah, because that doesn't get discussed a whole lot in the coverage.
And another aspect that's almost never mentioned is that not only were these missiles being fired, they were being fired from an area in southern Lebanon that was supposed to not have any Hezbollah fighters or weapons in there and was supposed to be monitored after 2006 by the United Nations. But the United Nations didn't do it. So, and that's very important, not only to just blame the United Nations, who wouldn't, but because it means that you can't just say, oh, Hezbollah now promises to move out of this area and not fire missiles, and we'll let the United Nations monitor it. Well, they were given their chance. They failed.
Yeah. So then what, though?
I think it's likely that Israel... basically has finished, not quite, but finished 95% of what they wanted to do in Gaza. And the last, they've taken out Hamas as a military organization, probably not taken them out as a political organization. They've also established Israeli control over something that your listeners have probably heard of called the Philadelphia Corridor. And that is a strip of land that it is the border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. And the reason that Israel wants to occupy it is that Egypt didn't effectively control it. They allowed Iran and Hamas to dig tunnels, hundreds of tunnels, under that area, smuggle in all the weapons they wanted, smuggle in Iranian military people to give assistance, and all the rest. Israel wants to cut that out in the future. And the reason they want to cut it out is not only because they want no more missiles fired into Israel from Hamas, but they don't want Hamas to gain political control thanks to their military weight in the region.
Makes sense. Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus at the University of Chicago. Let's kind of pivot into the presidential race right now. And, you know, it's interesting. I have a whole array of pundits from across the country that join me like yourself. And if I were to go to all of them right now and just sort of take their temperature on where the election is, I think a fair amount of them would say, look, Trump's not going to win this. Harris is going to win it. Fair number of them would say, look, Trump's going to win. You know, it looks really good for him. You know, the polling is kind of all over the place right now. I know that you're focused, and I think everyone should be focused on Pennsylvania. The candidates certainly are, because it seems like it's going to come all down to Pennsylvania, Charles.
I think you're exactly right. I don't see how either candidate wins without winning Pennsylvania. I know it's theoretically possible, but it looks like Pennsylvania is the key state, maybe Michigan as well. But and in Michigan, there's one extra candidate that may make a difference, and that's Jill Stein, who used to run as a Green candidate, and now she's running as the anti-Israel candidate. And so she may pull off some votes, too. And it doesn't take many. See, here's the problem with polling. It's not just difficult to poll. The problem is when you're talking about, first of all, you have to do it state by state, because you can't average up Ohio and Pennsylvania.
Right.
Ohio is going to go Republican. You need to just take Pennsylvania by itself, and you've got to make sure that you're not just polling in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, because they're going to go Democratic, or the middle of the state. Somebody once said it was a Philadelphia and Pittsburgh with Alabama in between them. And you've got to get them all. And if the margin is 20, 30, 50,000 votes, well, the margin of error in even the best
very narrow. Yeah, very narrow.
It's going to be very narrow. So you've got a real problem there, and you can also see that there are quite a few close states, including, quite surprisingly, North Carolina.
Yeah, I don't know why. I saw polling today. North Carolina seems to be in a little bit better shape for Trump, but that right now it's like 0.5 is the average. You know, one thing that struck me before I let you go is, and I've seen a number of focus groups, and I played some of the audio from one of the focus groups yesterday that was down in Georgia, in particular African American focus group. I was struck by the amount of African American people on a couple of panels that I've seen that have had this level of distrust of Kamala Harris, and also didn't think that she had the leadership capabilities. Charles, look, that's stating the obvious. We know that, right? But it's bleeding through to some of these undecided voters, including African Americans. So I find that rather interesting.
I do, too. And, of course, they're hurt very badly by competition in the job market and competition for government resources by all the illegal immigrants who've been let in across the border under the Biden-Harris administration. So they're angry about that. Remember, she grew up politically in California. And the illustration I would make is Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan comes from an Irish-American family. If he'd grown up in politics in Massachusetts like Tip O'Neill, he would have been an Irish politician. What was his nickname in California? Dutch. So it was not an ethnic politics state. And the most powerful politician in the state was Willie Brown, and we know what Kamala
Brown. There's some connections there, yes.
But the fact is, he didn't build his politics on an African-American base in the way you would have in Illinois, let's say. So she not only didn't have the African-American experience, her African-American father was really Jamaican.
Right.
But she also came to maturity politically in a state where racial politics was not a big deal, and to the extent that it is now, it's mostly Hispanic ethnic politics. So I can see why there's not a close.
Right. Well, it was one of the things that Trump was trying to address at the NABJ, and he tried to address it a little bit at the debate, and it just, you can't do that in a short fashion. So I understand everything that you were saying, and there are valid points to make about her, but again, it's real tough to do in short form. All right, Charles. Hey, by the way, did you know that Kamala Harris was a prosecutor? I've heard rumors to that. She's told a few people that.
Well, the striking thing about that is actually it means that she has to skip over her years in the Senate and her years as vice president.
She tries to do that for sure.
There's zero achievements in those years.
Charles, great to have you. Have a great week. We'll talk again soon. Appreciate it.
Good. Great.
Welcome back to the Mark Reardon Show. I'm Sue Thomas because I've lost him. I don't know where he is. He's somewhere in the building. He may have actually gone to the restroom. But while he's gone, I've got Ethan in here with me, and he's running the board. And I just sent over to Ethan today this week's History of the Lou with Sue. That's what I got to talk about, Ethan. And this week, it is kind of the history of the Central West End. And I've got Patrick Murphy on, if you've ever watched him on Channel 9. He did a really nice documentary about the Central West End because it was a really cool neighborhood, and then it went down, and then they kind of brought it back. And Candace O'Connor is also in with him, and she wrote a book about it. So if you like St. Louis history, you can tune in 97.1 on Sundays at 6 a.m. and at 6 p.m., and you can listen to the History of the Lou with Sue.
I tell you what, it's been really cool to see a lot of the different people you've been able to interview through that. And you really are, you're a couple months into it now. You're really touching on a lot of different areas. What's been your favorite one so far through these last couple of months?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure that I have one. I really enjoyed talking to Andy, who owns Crown Candy Kitchen, and the history of that, because that store goes back so far. They've been in that location forever. And he talks about having to give up metal stands. You know, they had stands where you got to eat ice cream during the World Wars because it was they were donating everything, all the metal to the war. And now that's why they've got wooden booths. Then I had in a couple of guys today from the Fox who worked with Stan Kahn. I got this really nice email from a woman who said, Sue, can you talk about Stan Kahn and the Fox? And I thought, okay. So we called these two guys up and they were adorable. So I don't know. I'm learning a lot and hopefully that's good. Oh, thanks for coming back to your own show.
Wait, can I tell you what happened?
Yes, please.
Not that it's going to matter at this point. I had to go talk to the boss. And I honestly, this is Ethan. This is why when I came out, I said, we're okay now. And you said, yeah, because I thought it was the end of the hour. In my mind, so we have several breaks. I'm just going to be honest with you. I'm not trying to lie about this.
No, I get it.
I walked out because I was like, I need to talk to Steve about something. And I completely thought it was the end of the hour. And that's why I checked with him, because we time out the end of the hour with your traffic.
Yeah.
And but thank you for covering.
Sure.
All of a sudden,
are you listening on the way back going, why are we talking about history of the Lewis?
No, I looked at my watch and I'm like, oh, wait a second. It's not past 4 o'clock. It's before 4 o'clock.
Okay, I've done this before, so I actually am sympathetic. One day, they went to me for traffic, and I wasn't there. And I said, I am so sorry. I just thought it was over.
Yeah, I don't do this very often. I don't do very often. But look, we're going to wrap things up for this hour, because I think we need to do that. We'll come back. We got traffic, and then hour number two with Sue's News. I'll try to pay a little closer attention to the clock and all that stuff. How about that?
That'd be great.
It's like my first day in radio or something like that. Hang in there.
Get more at 971talk.com. 971 FM Talk Podcast.
I still can't believe I did that. That is, it's not a radio first, but it certainly is something I haven't done. For those people just joining, I walked out of the studio right around 3:46 or something like that.
Oof.
I thought it was 3:56. And it wasn't. Yeah. And then the show started again, and Ethan and Sue just took it away. It was a great segment, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm using that one as a best of.
Ethan said, Sue, we got to come back. And I said, what?
Sorry. I'm so sorry about that.
So we were talking about history of the Lou with Sue, because that's really all I've got. You know what I'm saying there, Fred?
I do. I will make sure, at least I'll try to make sure that that does not happen again.
Oh, my gosh. It was hysterical. I'm sure maybe, people were like, what is happening?
I thought maybe Mark got a call from Spire.
Yeah. Well, that's a reference to the earlier part of the show.
When you get them.
Yes. Well, the show started with Sue on hold with Spire. We thought it might take days, but they actually jumped on with you, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Okay, now where do I go with the show? I had a couple of things, but no, that's creepy. That's too creepy. I'm not going to do that one. There's new information on the, Fred, did you hear this? The son of the second Trump assassin?
No.
What?
Okay. It's creepy, but I'll do it as less creepy as I can. I had not heard about this guy. So the son of Ryan Routh, that's the dude that was arrested in connection with the assassination attempt, has now been taken into custody on federal charges of possessing child pornography. So what happened was, is they wanted to look into this guy. The feds did, because they wanted to see if there was a connection. So they start going through his phones and stuff like that. They say this guy is, he's into so many different things. He's so weird. He's been in the media before, and now he's got a kid. Or maybe himself, who knows, that's dealing in child porn. They say that they discovered hundreds of files with child pornography during the search of his residence in North Carolina. And they say, look, that was in connection with an investigation unrelated to child exploitation, because it was an investigation related into the attempted assassination of a former president. And, you know, they say that according to the criminal complaint, this kid's name is Orrin Routh. In North Carolina, they searched his home. A review of an SD card in a Samsung phone found in his bedroom allegedly uncovered hundreds of files of child sexual abuse images. Files included videos from a known series. I don't know what that means. That includes videos of an adult man with a prepubescent girl under the age of 10. I mean, there, it's creepy. I'm not going to keep going here. But how bizarre is that, right? Mm. All right, something more positive. I got a couple of stories here that I don't, maybe you guys talked about this last week. So my apologies if you did. Did you talk about the cat that made its trek from Yellowstone to California?
No.
Okay, so we have stories like this every once in a while. And, you know, I think that the movie Homeward Bound sort of recounted a story that was not unlike this. So this is about the cat named Rainbow. And by the way, it's not spelled R-A-N-B-O-W. It's spelled R-A-Y-N-E. B-E-A-U, Rainbow.
Well, I'm annoyed.
Yeah, I know, right? That's kind of the most annoying part of this story. So Susan Anguilano is the name of this person. They're on vacation in Yellowstone on June 4th. They don't even put this on Facebook. She's devastated. They lose this cat. Now, look, I have cats. I've had cats for a long time. Never really travel with my cat. If I go in a mobile trailer or something like that, an RV, and I have my cat goes missing, I'm going to kind of put that on myself because I'm not sure
right.
that you should be doing that. But anyway, they love their cats. I love my cats. George Gray loves his cats.
Of course.
Would have reaction to this. So the cat gets out of the RV and it runs off and they can't get it to come back. And they're there for a few more days and she's just devastated. She drives back to California with her husband. They don't talk because they're devastated. And then fast forward to just a couple of weeks ago when there's another woman here. Let me see if I can get to this part of the story because my computer just kind of made a different
Wait,
decision
so it's
for
weeks
me.
Later?
It is. This is more than a month later.
Okay.
Okay, more than a month. June 4th. So this is into July at this point. Let's see here. I can tell you the exact date because she says that, I don't know why I'm having so much trouble here, guys. Okay, July 31st. This woman named Alexander Betts is at her job at Sutter Roseville Medical Center in Roseville, California. It's hot that day, triple digits. And she says she hears, as she's going into the office or the hospital where she works, she hears some howling coming from bushes. And she thought it was a cat in heat or in labor. And she notices this small brownish cat near a storm drain. She hangs with it for a little while. And her employees, her fellow employees say, look, it's been here for a while. Maybe it belongs to someone nearby. So she checks in with her sister who worked in an animal shelter. And the sister says, look, they howl like this if they're in distress, in heat, or lost. So they fed the cat and then they scanned it for a microchip. It had a microchip and it was back to its owner. Saturday afternoon, Susan gets the call just a few days later.
Oh my
she doesn't
gosh.
Even pick up the call. She sees it come in and then she calls back because it was actually the animal shelter that called and said, hey, we have your cat.
Oh, that's amazing.
Now they're reunited. But how about that?
And how far would that be?
I don't want to misstate it here. I think it's 800 miles.
That Holy. Is nuts!
Yeah, 800 miles. Now, one of the questions, the obvious question that they had here is, did somebody help bring the cat
right.
back?
You wonder.
But they don't think so. And by the way, that person would have had to have gone in the right direction, right? They talk about in this story in the LA Times that there was a, we probably talked about it, in 2012, there was a Labrador named Bucky that walked 500 miles from Virginia to South Carolina to be eventually Shoot. Reunited. But that's crazy. 800 miles from Yellowstone to California. There you go. There's your feel-good story of the day after some creepy news here on 97.1 FM Talk.
These allegations are deeply concerning.
Does the president have any comment?
We're not going to comment.
It's not clear messaging.
No. And now, Sue's News. Brought to you by Sue.
Well, I feel like I should throw this in just because, you know, it's American and it's interesting. On this day in history, 235 years ago in 1789, the first Supreme Court was established, and it had six justices nominated by George Washington. And it wasn't until 1869 that Congress set the number of justices to the nine that we still have today. I did not know we started with six.
Yeah, me neither.
And then 56 years ago today, in 1968, Harry Reasoner and Mike Wallace hosted the debut of 60 Minutes.
Oh, look at that.
How about that?
That was back when they actually used to do real
Correct.
Stories and they weren't agenda-driven like they have been in the last decade.
Yep, and that's a shame.
It is
a
shame.
Because that was a good show.
Because it was a good show, and I looked
yep.
forward to it. And
yes.
I talked about, you know, my deep love, and I miss him dearly, Tim Russert, Meet the Press, used to be destination television. 60 Minutes
yes.
used to be destination television. I saw some ads over the weekend, some promos for 60 Minutes. The stories looked rather intriguing. And then I thought to myself, I can't trust them for one damn minute
nope.
because they came in here making St. Louis look like a bunch of white supremacists because we were trying to get Kim Gardner to move out of the way so criminals would actually be prosecuted.
Exactly.
So 60 Minutes. R.I.P.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I say.
Well, on the complete opposite end of the spectrum from 60 Minutes, this show we do have sound for. This show came out 47 years ago. It premiered on ABC.
Exciting and
oh, I love this show.
When
you're
baby.
Like a 12 and 13 year old kid, and you're watching Julie Twos and the rest of the cast of The Love Boat. That was a glorious thing back then. I just must tell you,
we were allowed to watch it. We had to go to the neighbors to watch it.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, because you had good parents, right? Well, nothing against my parents listening right now, but they let
me watch
The Love Boat.
We didn't have to sneak out.
The Love Boat, and then I guess Fantasy Island.
Well, right after it.
Yeah.
Now, Ethan. The plane right afterward.
You had to pull this audio from The Love Boat. Are you familiar with this at all?
Never heard of it.
Okay. Well, these were gems in the late 70s on ABC on a Saturday night, Ethan.
I got absolutely nothing.
Well, you know what? That's just as well.
Do you know Fantasy Island? They remade that into a movie.
Because I think I've seen the movie. But
did they do a series also?
Yeah, I didn't know it was connected off an old show.
It is. Yeah. Most things are. There's nothing new.
Nothing new.
No. Just assume. That's great.
Yeah, this will not be surprising to you, this next story. Reggie Bush is suing USC, the NCAA, and Pac-12 over missed compensation for his name and likeness while he was playing football in college. Now, Reggie, of course, won the Heisman when he was running back for USC in 2005. One of his attorneys said, quote, "This case is not just about seeking justice for Reggie Bush. It's about setting a precedent for the fair treatment of all college athletes. Our goal is to rectify this injustice, pave the way for a system where athletes are rightfully recognized, compensated, and treated fairly for their contributions." That's what his attorney said. Well, I mean, he's just going to be one of a landslide.
So it's like sports reparations kind of?
Yeah, that's interesting. Fred, we might want to follow on that. And there's some good experts that we would have to talk about that. I think that's fascinating.
They say that USC, NCAA, Pac-12 continued to benefit financially, even when Reggie was out and playing in the NFL. I mean, they were using his likeness, and I don't think that's wrong.
By the way, can I say one thing on the football-related topic that I think Ethan will appreciate? Maybe Fred, too. Did you watch the Redskins? I'm sorry. Oh, my gosh. I've just been canceled.
Here is it.
Holy smokes. My God, ladies and gentlemen. I'm so sorry about that.
I hear Steve Moore's footsteps now.
Did you watch the Commanders last night?
I did not.
Okay, let me just say this. And he's my backup. He's bound to be my starter, and I think he's going to be my keeper. Jaden Daniels, holy smokes, was that a great night for him?
It was unbelievable.
And an awesome game. This kid, you know, look, he went number 2 overall from LSU. He was the Heisman winner, and the Bears had a choice to make. They went with Caleb. He's probably going to be okay, but he's the Bears. But, man, Jaden looked amazing last night.
Yeah, I saw stories this morning saying he introduced himself to the NFL.
Well, and what's his name? With Joe Buck last night, Troy Aikman, I can't believe I'm forgetting. Troy made a comment that was interesting to me. You know, in this era of the quarterbacks and everybody transferring in the transfer portal, he started 55 games in college. He was like a 5-year guy. Whoa. He started at Arizona State before he went to LSU. So 55 games on your resume gives him more experience than some of these other rookie quarterbacks. But he was super impressive last night.
Very good. He's really good, yeah.
Actors get injured on the set all the time, and sometimes it looks so good you can't really tell that it's an accident. And BuzzFeed has come up with a list of those times. One of them was in The Princess Bride, which is why I bring it up now, because we all love The Princess Bride.
Princess Bride!
Have you seen that, Ethan?
I don't think I have.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Even my daughter's seen it, and she loved it.
It is time for you to watch. It's very sweet.
Watch it with the wife.
Yes.
She would love it.
She'll love it.
It's a romantic movie. It's really good.
Weekend activity.
It's got Andre the Giant in it. You can't beat it. Anyway.
And Billy Crystal.
Ethan Stills.
He wants you to have fun storming the castle. Anyone? Anyone? All right. The Princess Bride. There is a scene where Christopher Guest bonks Cary Elwes on the head with his sword. How do you pronounce it?
Elwes.
On the head with his sword, and they did it in one take, but he knocked out Cary for real. So when you see
that scene,
when he bonks him on the head, he knocked him out for reals.
That's fascinating.
It ended up being the most realistic take. So that's what you see in the movie.
Right.
There's a scene in Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, where Viggo Mortensen broke 2 toes by kicking a helmet. So when he screams and falls to his knees, that is not acting. No. He actually broke toes during that. So when you watch Princess Bride, watch for that particular
good to know. Will do.
Because it's kind of crazy. And I have one good news story today. There's a runner from North Carolina named Tara Dower who just broke a world record by hiking the entire Appalachian Trail in 40 days, 18 hours, 5 minutes. That's just under 2,200 miles. She did an average of 54 miles a day. And a guy from Belgium held the record, and she beat him by more than 13 hours. She raised a bunch of money for charity, and gave it to Girls on the Run.
So just do the math on the did you say 54 miles? How do you do that? How did you do that? You're not just walking.
You've got to be doing some running.
Right.
Yeah. She must be a serious runner slash athlete. And finally, in Sue's news, we have today's random fact. Okay, I did not know this. The Oval Office has pressure sensors in the floor so that the Secret Service can monitor exactly where the president is when they're not allowed inside. Isn't that fascinating?
That's crazy.
Wow.
So if something does happen, they know exactly where to go?
Correct.
I've never heard that one.
I don't know either.
I don't know about you guys, but I feel like I am constantly underestimating the amount of technology that our government and just that there is in the world that we just don't think about. And honestly, I don't know if I want to think about it because it probably would scare me to
you
know how much
because they have computer chips in all our brains right now and they're controlling us? What's wrong with
maybe.
That?
Maybe. Who knows?
Yeah. No, you know, look, I think to your point, you know, this stuff that they're investigating with this second assassin, I can't even imagine the pinging, all this technology that they have to track people when they go all in on these investigations. I think we'd all be rather shocked.
All of this, yet they couldn't figure out who had cocaine in the White House.
I know. Isn't that weird? We couldn't figure that out, and we can't make
still
a phone call if we're
head.
Passing by the St. Louis Zoo, but we can put a rover on Mars and all that technology, too.
That's it for Sue's News.
Thank you, Sue. Yeah. I appreciate that. Thank you, Ethan. Fred, the Hall of Famer, in here as well. I felt like listening to a little Prince with his guitar this afternoon. We're coming back with more in a moment. You know who I have not had the privilege of speaking to in a while? That's the governor of Missouri, Mike Parson, and he's going to join us this afternoon in the 5 o'clock hour. This is the execution night for Marcellus Williams to finally leave the planet, and hopefully this will all take place. I don't think the United States Supreme Court will get involved, but we'll explain that case and talk about, really, Lisha Gale, who was the subject of a brutal murder, and I don't really like to mention Marcellus's name because she was the victim, and we're going to focus on her a little bit here after 5 o'clock. Kat Rosenfield is with me right now. She writes at the Free Press, and if you're not subscribing to the Free Press, you don't know what you're missing right now, but wrote a piece that I saw last week that kind of fascinated me, so we invited Kat to join us this afternoon. Kat Rosenfield, how are you? Welcome to 97.1 FM Talk in St. Louis.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So the name of the piece was To the Woman Who Trashed Me on Twitter, and you tell this fascinating story of a woman that you call Jane, not her real name. But you got to go back in history just a little bit to back in 2016 when Trump was first running for president, don't you?
Yeah, Jane was a colleague of mine, and around the time that Trump became the nominee for president, as I'm sure you know, a lot of people who worked in media where I'm situated kind of lost their minds a little bit, and
they continue to
just a tad. It got very censorious. It got very kind of fraught to be on the side of free speech, which I always have been a free speech liberal, and those of us who were still willing to talk about being in support of free speech were sort of excoriated in public, but in private we became these sort of like secret confessors in our Twitter DMs and inboxes became like a little confessional for people who weren't actually very happy with what was happening, but didn't want to say so on main, didn't want to say so out loud because they didn't want to be canceled. And Jane was one of these people who used to message me and say that she was concerned about the climate, that she was concerned about her career, that she didn't like what was happening. And that went on for about 2 years, and then it stopped when she decided instead to kind of publicly attack me for being problematic.
So you even had, again, not a real name, but you talked about her. She was a colleague, and you guys had freelance gigs at the same time, and she wrote, "I'm trying to tell myself every day that this censorship, hypersensitivity, etc., is the natural exuberance of a new movement still feeling out its own limitations. I spend so much time every day now wondering if my peers actually want to suspend the First Amendment or are just angry, emotional posturing." So that happens, and then 5 years later, you write an article about COVID, right? And then you hear a little bit from Jane again.
I had written about the campaign to push Joe Rogan off Spotify, which I thought was potentially problematic in terms of what it implied for free expression, the First Amendment, free speech. And then I discovered that Jane had taken exception to it and was just sort of publicly trashing me on Twitter with another podcaster who I also will not name. And, you know, the thing about this experience, it was obviously it's very unpleasant to discover that you're being stabbed in the back by somebody you considered a friend. But the thing about this that I think is more important than what I personally went through is that a lot of people have had a similar experience to this, because we do live in a moment, and did then and do now, where people are very opportunistic and very tribal and willing to sacrifice trust and connection in order to participate in this very binary thinking.
It's amazing. So, but why, Kat, why not just say, hey, Jane, F you, I'm going to release your DMs, and this is what you were saying. Why even try to protect her at this point? I'm curious.
I just want no part of that paradigm. I think it is incredibly toxic and incredibly ugly, and I'm trying to be the change that I want to see in the world. So, yeah, I won't be naming her.
I can appreciate that and I understand that. But you also related this, and I don't know if it's just because she's got the same name as you, but you related this to something that you read in Kat Timpf's new book, right? Explain that.
Yeah, that's right. Timpf, who I've actually been on TV with a couple of times. I think people enjoy the novelty of us having the same first name. she has written a new book. Everyone should check it out. It's really wonderful, very funny, very vulnerably and well-written. It's called I Used to Like You Until. And she talks in it about this trap of binary thinking that leads people to disassociate from their friends, their confidants, over politics. And what she's identifying there is the same phenomenon that I have written about at the Free Press before, which I call fandom politics. She calls it binary thinking. But the point is that it's very tribal, and it is something that has been ascendant, I think, for the last 10 years or so, but it's gotten especially potent. It gets especially potent around elections and around this one in particular.
Yeah, and I don't know how we get out of that. In you know, I was thinking about this even this week with a friend of mine. I have a pretty, used to be a good friend that still works for CBS News. We go way back to journalism school at the University of Missouri, been friends for decades. And he didn't like what I was saying on the X, formerly Twitter, a few years ago. And essentially, I mean, we were relatively close, and then that was it. It was like done. There was no conversation or anything like that. And unfortunately, there's a lot of that going on right now. It's probably going to go on again this Thanksgiving at people's homes.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that it's probably true. You were saying, I don't know how we get out of it. I don't know how we get out of it either, except by individually choosing not to participate in it. And so I still maintain friendships with people who I disagree with politically and will continue to do so. Well, and hopefully leading by example will work.
Yeah, and I think, look, and I've said this before as someone who is more libertarian conservative. Most of my friends are not libertarian conservative. They're more liberal. And, you know, I kind of deal with that. But I'm curious about your thoughts on how the media is handling a lot of these situations right now. I played a soundbite from Hillary Clinton yesterday where she's defending Kamala Harris not doing interviews because apparently it's somehow sexist to demand that a female presidential candidate actually talks to the media. But there's a lot of stuff going on. One of the reasons I love the Free Press, because I think Barry's done a great job over there with real journalism, Kat, and I don't see that a lot in the rest of the so-called capital J journalism world out there.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with you on that. I mean, I, of course, very partial to the Free Press. I work there. I think we're wonderful. I think that there are a number of good journalists working in mainstream news organizations who are still doing a good job, who are unbiased, who are objective, and who are doing their best to remain open and to get the truth out there. But when you mentioned Hillary Clinton, I think it is very interesting, actually, that you can trace the rise of a lot of the sort of tribalism. Again, this is something that Timpf talks about in her book. Back to her basket of deplorables comment that she made on the campaign trail in 2016. And a very interesting thing that happened then was that people on the other side allowed themselves to be defined by that comment. They were like, you called me deplorable? Yeah, I'm going to be hella extra deplorable. I'm going to be so deplorable it makes your hair stand on end. And that kind of reactive, almost oppositional, defiant behavior where you allow somebody who treats you with contempt and with loathing to sort of define who you are and who you choose to be is something that Tim talks about in her book and I think is part of what makes this so toxic. So everybody basically has to opt out or it's just going to keep getting worse.
I love, by the way, you use a quote from Kat Timpson in her book, and she says, it's pathetic, but it's true. Politics makes us fight with the people we actually know on behalf of people who don't even know we exist. That says a lot right there, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a terrible thing about this binary trap is that it has us at each other's throats. So much of the culture war stuff that we fight about with our friends, with our family, all of that is a distraction from what is actually happening. And it is to the benefit of people who actually have power, who could be making the world a better place and who are let off the hook for doing that because they would prefer us to be fighting with each other rather than looking at what they're up to.
You're probably right about that. Kat Rosenfield, thank you so much for jumping on here with me in St. Louis this afternoon. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right, take care. You know, and we would definitely disagree on the media and the way that the media is handling all of this, because I don't even think that that's in question right now when it comes to fairness. And I do love the free press, because Barry, and by the way, Barry Weiss is no conservative. She left the New York Times not because it was too liberal, but because they weren't interested in truly acknowledging all sides of issues.
Wow.
And this came, you know, with the Tom Cotton op-ed that they wanted to spike, and that's the circumstances of how she left. But overall, Kat's point is also, I think, a little broader on that spot, because we all get backed into our corners. But I think that the corners would not be as extreme if the media landscape was more fair.
Agreed.
Because one of the reasons that we're so tribal is you got the conservative, you know, punditry world, Fox News, used to be Rush Limbaugh, shows like mine, right? And then you have everything else on the other side.
Yep.
And there is no effort to, well, we used 60 Minutes as an example earlier, right? And it's sad because we used to be able to think that 60 Minutes really stood for something, that they were going to go. Mike Wallace is a great example. When Mike Wallace was one of the correspondents on 60 Minutes, he would give everyone hell, right?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter who was sitting next to him. He was going to ask tough questions of that person. Consequences be damned, right? But we don't see that anymore. I don't see the intensity being in an equitable way dispersed across. Of course it's not, right? So I think that the media and the way that they've become tribal, because they're cheerleaders, they're forcing agendas, they're not interested in telling both sides of the story. Look, Joe Biden today mentioned climate in his speech to the UN 6 times. He only mentioned Iran twice. You know, in a fair media world, the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post would do a story about that saying, wait, maybe we're a little off on our priorities here, but they won't do that because they believe the climate science nonsense and the junk, and they want to stuff that down people's faces and, you know, down their throats. And that makes everything worse, because you got the NPR audience believing one thing, you got the rest of the people believing another thing, which is usually the truth, and there's nowhere in the middle that people can meet, sadly. We're coming back with more in a moment. Hang in there. All right, Sue, you know, we have talked quite a bit about downtown St. Louis and businesses that are not very comfortable because of crime issues, et cetera. We know that the AT&T building sold for what? A couple of bucks. It was like $2 or $3 or something like that. I mean, in the whole scheme of things, it really was, because it was $3 million when it was $300 million. The person who bought that building, I think, plans some apartments.
Huge.
Luxury. It is huge.
Good.
In retail.
Good.
So there are some people that I think are believing in downtown, including
Good.
Alex Oliver, who's with us. He's with Oliver Properties, and he's developing some apartments on Washington Avenue. Alex, how are you this afternoon? Welcome to 97.1 FM Talk.
Hi there. I'm doing good.
Well, the question for you would be, why, when everyone's down on downtown St. Louis with crime and other issues, are you thinking this is a good idea to develop in downtown St. Louis on Wash Avenue?
Yeah, I mean, I've been very encouraged. We've been we acquired our property on Wash Ave about 9 months ago, and we've had an incredible success down here. So we've been
good
upgrading existing apartments. So that's really kind of our bread and butter. So we're taking on, you know, these are historic buildings that were converted to apartments about 20 years ago. And they've been under-amenitized and maybe kind of mismanaged and not reinvested in the last few years. So we're taking on existing buildings added amenities, better, stronger management, and really focusing on neighborhoods that are quite honestly quite walkable with restaurants and shops and bars and amenities right out the people's front door. And we've had incredible success.
Love it. But some of those, I mean, look, if we're looking at Wash Avenue in particular, and that's only a few blocks from where we're sitting right now, there are a lot of good things that are going on down there. And I see a lot of activity on weekends. But we've also seen videos of some of the apartment buildings that are nearby in the middle of the night with shots being fired and people running and scurrying into alleyways. So there's no doubt that there are issues related to crime and safety in those neighborhoods as well. So how do you confront, what's the relationship you have, for example, with local leaders, if we have any, or law enforcement?
Well, you know, we try to work as much as we can with, you know, the city and GSL and the police. And there's also, you know, the downtown SID. We're a supporter of the new downtown North SID, which I think is going to add some additional, you know, eyes and ears and security on the streets. But we also really focus on, you know, are our buildings secure? Are we doing good screening for our residents? Are we making sure we're getting the right people in the building, keeping the wrong people out of the building? And the more people that live down here and the more people that are out on the street, that's more eyeballs and ears and cars and people that discourage people that do want to cause problems from being in the area.
I'm amazed by, now look, I own a home and I haven't rented it in a long time, but when I drive around, and Sue, even when you go down 44, you look at what's happening, you know, near SLU, there's so many apartments that are going up. There's desperate need, I guess, for more housing, including apartments in the area. So I'm guessing that your demand is very high right now.
Yeah, demand's been really strong. So, you know, over the winter and in the spring, we were doing a lot of renovations at the building. So we hadn't really started active leasing yet until we got into more like in the May area. And in the last 90 days, we actually have a couple buildings there on Wash Ave. We've signed over 90 leases in the last 90 days, which is an incredible leasing pace.
Well, what is your thought or vision for, because I mentioned the guy, I can't remember who bought the AT&T building, but I was told that part of his vision is for more retail downtown, which, let's face it, we don't have a lot of that right now because it doesn't seem like there's enough demand for that. Do you think there should be more retail? I mean, there's not even grocery stores that are, you know, within, I guess Schnucks is within walking distance of Wash Avenue, but Fields Foods closed down. So we still have, you know, there's challenges. Gas stations are tough to find downtown, et cetera.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a mixed neighborhood. You know, that's one thing that has drawn us down here, and I think it draws our residents who want to live down here, is that mix of there's residential, there's retail, there's shops, there's office. And yes, that does make for a stronger residential neighborhood or really a working business neighborhood when there is more service providing retailers. But it's a supply demand, you know, balancing act. Like you said, is there enough demand down here to sustain those retailers who are here? And that's why we're really focusing on what is our bread and butter is multifamily housing. Are we driving more residents down here that have disposable incomes, that are going out to eat, that are frequenting these retailers to make it so they can be successful and continue to grow? And we're having some success on that front as well. We have ground floor retail spaces in several of our buildings, and we've got a couple leases coming and some LOIs we're negotiating. So the people who want to be down here because they see the traffic.
Hey, Alex, it's Sue. I think one of the cool things about doing stuff like this is that we've got all these really sweet old buildings with all this character, and that's got to be part of the draw.
Oh, yeah. So I've been investing in real estate, multifamily buildings in St. Louis for 17 years. I'm a transplant, moved here in 2007, started buying, you know, fourplex and duplexes in South City, and really fell in love with the historic character. And I think that is a unique nature that at least the properties we're focusing on along Wash Ave, they do have this historic character. You mentioned the new construction near SLU and in St. Louis County and in St. Charles, and there's a place for that. I think there's some real character and you know, the large floor plans, the tall ceilings, the amazing character in the buildings is very unique to our downtown infrastructure, and I think that's got a real appeal.
How do you use some of that character in the apartments? I mean, the best example, I think, from that area is what City Museum represents, right? Because you still have the infrastructure from
the International Shoe Company.
Right, exactly. So are there things like that in some of the apartments?
Yeah, so our 6-core building, that's right at between 10th and 11th on Washington. So we're at 1000 Washington right there. It has these large brick archways all throughout the first floor, you know, 14 to 16 foot ceilings. Several of our units are actually 2-story units. The ceilings were so tall that they're basically like townhouses inside the units. So we've taken advantage of the ceiling heights. We've got exposed wood, you know, beams on the ceiling. You see the brick archways. It makes for these really tall windows on all the window lines. So it really takes advantage of that big open footprint that these old buildings had.
Awesome. Well, Alex, thanks for jumping on here with me. You can go ahead and give your website out if you want people to kind of check that out.
Yeah, so Oliver Properties, so OPSTL, Oliver Properties STL, is our company website. And then our downtown building that we're doing most of our leasing at is Six Chord, S-I-X-C-O-R-D. So Six Chord Downtown Apartments.
Alex Oliver, thank you so much. Good luck with everything. Keep us posted.
All right, I appreciate it.
We got one more hour to go here on 97.1 FM Talk. And I mentioned this a little earlier, have not chatted with Governor Parson. Haven't really asked him if he's got another Kansas City Chiefs tattoo, for example. we have not visited with the governor in a while. But look, it is a serious issue. We're going to talk about Marcellus Williams and the execution that's set for 6 o'clock tonight. We'll talk a little bit about the border. And he went to Panama recently as well. Then there's a story that has kind of developed in the Springfield area related to some gender stuff, which is always interesting. We'll get to that. Plus, an audio cut of the day and more coming up.
Get more at 971talk.com. 971 FM Talk Podcast. This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. Follow Mark on Twitter at Mark Reardon KFTK and Instagram at Mark Talk. This is the Mark Reardon Show.
It's been a little while since we've had Governor Mike Parson on. He's going to jump in here in just a moment. Ethan is setting that up on the phone lines. Coming up in a little bit, though, at 525, Erica Sanzi is going to be with me. She is the director of outreach at a group called Parents Defending Education, and this is a Missouri issue down in Springfield where, and you're going to have a lot of this that's going to pop up. You have evidence now that some of the public school officials in Springfield blatantly deceive parents by allowing trans students to hide their gender identity and their preferred pronouns. This is something that I'm expecting to navigate as a father of a 9.5-year-old in the future, but we'll get Eric on. Plus, I have an audio cut of the day. I also want to spend a little bit of time here after our conversation with the governor on Lisha Gale related to the Marcellus Williams case, and we will talk about that as we welcome Governor Parson into the fray this afternoon. Governor Mike Parson, it's been a little while. How are you this afternoon?
Hey, I'm good. I'm good, Mark. Everything's going good as can be expected right now.
Well, the Chiefs are 3-0. I mean, what more do we have to say, right?
I'll tell you what, they need to do a better job of winning, though. They're this hard on an old guy like me. You know, I sent them a note the other night, a text to the coach, and says, hey, you guys need to win by 10 points. Make my life a little easier.
Can you just give me Andy Reid's number so I can do that at a certain point, too? Would you mind just doing that? You know.
Well, I don't know about that, Mark. I like you, but there is a limit to my kindness.
No, I understand. Well, let's start here. This isn't as, you know, fun to talk about as football, but I think it's important. And there's an execution that's going to take place tonight of Marcellus Williams. This is a case, as you know, that's gotten a lot of coverage here in St. Louis. Lisha Gale, I like to focus on the, you know, you were a law enforcement guy. I like to focus on the victims, Governor, not the murderer. But this was a case, the way I look at it, is he's very guilty. They tried to get him off on a technicality. They claimed there was new DNA evidence. There was no new DNA evidence, and now it's time for him to leave the planet, isn't it?
You know, look, this is a case that's drawn a lot of attention. It's drawn a lot of national attention. But the bottom line is it doesn't change the fact of a brutal murder that occurred and he was convicted of, and he's went through the entire appeals process, and at no time has he been found innocent of any of these crimes. So it's unfortunate people have this mindset that he's innocent, but there's never been any evidence whatsoever to support that.
So in this particular case, at this point, is the only thing that can stop this the United States Supreme Court?
That would be correct. They could step in if they so choose, but that would be very rare if they did that.
Yeah, so so it is scheduled to take place tonight at 6 o'clock, and I just wanted to make sure that we were all, you know, on point on that. You know, I mentioned something here at the beginning. You're toward the end here of this term, and I know you're still doing your work. I'd like to find out a little bit about your Panama trip that you took, but are you starting to think here about the last couple of months of the term?
You know, I don't think there's any question about that. It's been you know, for the 6.5 years I'll be here when I finish up, there's so many things that have occurred, good and bad. I mean, you know, you've had your worst droughts, your worst floods, you've had civil unrest, COVID-19, train derailments, chemical spills, and just tornado on down the list. But we've still been able to manage to keep the state on the right track during all that time. And, you know, we've just had a lot of accomplishments in there. I-70, our economy, for the most part, is in better shape than a lot of the other states. So there's been a lot of positive things happen, too. But I'm looking forward to going home. I'll be honest with you. I want to end it being governor. I have no desire to be in the political arena any longer. And I just kind of want to leave here with my head up.
Well, there's some. I want to ask you, just kind of going back to the legislative session and maybe pushing ahead here with what Mike Kehoe might have to deal with. Obviously, there's been some, you know, issues in the Senate in particular with personalities, et cetera. There are people that don't think that Mike Parson is conservative enough and that was part of the problem in pushing some legislation. This drives me crazy when people play the are you conservative enough game. But how do you know that kind of stuff gets said? How do you respond to that?
You know, you just got to be satisfied of who you are and know what you did. You know, when people say that, I think to myself, I've signed the strongest pro-life legislation in our state's history, the strongest Second Amendment in our state's history. I've cut taxes 5 times on income tax that no governor or state's history has ever done. We've got the highest revenues we ever had because people are going back to work. And when people say that, it's just like, kind of, what do you base that on? Do you just base it on because you don't like everything that we do? Well, you're never going to have a governor that's going to do everything you like. So, but I'm pretty proud of what's happened. You know, I felt like I've tried to do the best I could and keep my conservative values at the forefront.
You also have to be proud, I would think, about your appointments and how they fared in this most recent election, aren't you?
There's no question. You know, I appointed 5 statewide candidates since I've been governor, and the only time that's ever been done in our state's history has been 1 time that somebody's picked 1 statewide. And right now, at the end of those elections, we're 12-0. I picked Vivek Malik. I picked Andrew Bailey, Mike Kehoe, Eric Schmidt, Scott Fitzpatrick, and all of them have been extremely successful. And I'll tell you, Mark, it wasn't about whether they were my friends or not. It was about what is the future of our state. Those are the people we have on bench. And kind of go back to what you said. You know, which one's the most conservative than the other? If we're fighting over that, I'm not sure what we're fighting about.
Yeah.
I mean, because you just look at the other options you got. I'm still taking anybody that is truly a conservative.
Well, look, I kind of look at it that way, too, which is one of the reasons that I wanted to ask that question. Let me ask you about the border issue. You know, it's interesting. I've told this story a couple of times. The BBC came to town a couple of weeks ago here to St. Louis. They broadcast a show back to England, and they sat down with me and my friend and colleague, Jane Duker, who used to work for a governor in Bob Holden. And they were asking me about the border issue, why people in Missouri care about the border issue. And I said, first and foremost, I care as an American when I see people coming over the border and flooding it like we have. But obviously, this affects, and we just had a devastating thing happen here in St. Louis, as you know, with a police officer who was killed over the weekend in a DWI crash from a migrant that wasn't allowed in this country. So as you kind of prepare to leave, what would you say to the BBC if they ask you, hey, Governor Parson, Missouri's not a border state. Why do you care about these issues with immigration?
Because the bottom line is just what happened to that officer. Regardless how that person got here, he's not supposed to be here, and he's not supposed to be out there involved in those kind of incidents. And that's why you're trying to protect people, because the bottom line is when you talk over 12 million people coming across the border, coming into our country, they're coming to Missouri. I'm telling you right now, as sure as I'm sitting here, they are coming in some form, some fashion, and we were going to have to deal with the bad side of that issue. And there'll be more incidents like this if we keep allowing them in our country and we keep allowing them in our state.
And so that becomes frustrating for, I think, for you, maybe for me as well, just because if you take a stand against illegal immigration, not legal, but illegal immigration, then somehow you're portrayed as a xenophobic person and bigoted, et cetera.
You know what, Mark? I have did so much to try to help the Hispanic community in the state of Missouri, to put them on commissions, to put them on boards, to listen to their concerns. You know what? They are good people that come here and come here the right way. I think trying to tie them to say, okay, they're all supportive of everybody coming across the border illegal is wrong. And I think a lot of times they get in that box just like I do. And it's not true at all. People that come here legally want other people to come here legally. And as to what the American is made out of, our country's made out of, and to think you can shortcut this process and everything's going to be just hunky-dory. It's not. I'm just telling you right now, we see it all over our country dealing with these problems.
Absolutely. Governor Mike Parson back with us. Tell me about your trip to Panama. You were there a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, you know what? That was a great trip for me. I wanted to go down there. Our National Guard has been in Panama. Part of their assignment is to guard the Panama Canal, and they've been down there since 1985 that we've helped secure the Panama Canal. So it was great to go down there to visit with the troops and tell them thanks for what they do and how important that Panama Canal is. The other thing that's down there, Kansas City Southern Rail out of Kansas City, they're the ones that run the rail up and down the Panama Canal. They have train service that goes through there. And so it was really good down there firsthand. And then, again, I'll be honest with you, just to see what kind of blunder our government does sometimes when we give the Panama Canal away. And why we ever did that is mind-boggling to me.
Well, Governor, thank you so much for jumping on here. I know it's been a little tough to communicate and connect here over the past 6 months or so, and I don't know if we'll connect again before the end of the term, but good luck with everything. And I don't know, I already hit you up for Andy Reid's number. You said no, but do you have any plans for any more Chiefs tattoos? That would be a valid question here.
I don't know. Three-peat would be a big deal is all I want to say. Three-peat would be a big deal, but we'll see. Hey, Mark, thanks for your friendship over the years and for what you do, really getting people the right message and making sure they know the truth. So I appreciate what you do.
Governor Parson, awesome to have you. Thank you so much and good luck with everything.
All right, we'll see you. Bye.
Always great to have the governor on. I guess I should have asked for he said all those nice things about me. Shouldn't I get a proclamation? Isn't that what they call those things?
No, you're supposed to say thank you. Oh. That was awfully nice of you.
I did, but a proclamation would be kind of nice too. Let me wind this, though, back to a very serious topic, and that is Lisha Gale. It's not Marcellus Williams. This is not about Marcellus Williams. It's about Lisha Gale, who was brutally murdered in 1998. She was a reporter at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And this case has come up time and time again because with death penalty cases, all the do-gooders out there, they don't care one bit if Marcellus Williams was guilty of stabbing this woman 38 times. Oh. They don't care about that. They just are against the death penalty. They want to get him off death row because he's innocent. The problem is he's not innocent. And the death penalty opponents always have that little nagging thing that sticks out because they claim innocence, but they're never innocent. They really aren't. Like maybe one person in the history of time. Maybe two. But not very many. So there's a column that was in the Post in mid-August when all this kind of came into the forefront again. Because as you might remember, in an embarrassing way, Wesley Bell, who I told you and I warned you, he's not going to be much of an upgrade from Cori Bush, ladies and gentlemen. He won't embarrass St. Louis as much as she did, but he's not going to be an upgrade. And for whatever reason, maybe it's because he knew he couldn't prosecute anyone on Mike Brown, he had to, because he made promises, I'd reopen that case. We couldn't do it because there was no evidence to do it, right? Because nothing happened. Right. It was Mike Brown that was the criminal, not Darren Wilson. But in this case, he wanted to get Marcellus Williams off the death row. So what is he going to do? He's going to file, this motion and that motion. We have new DNA evidence, right? Well, problem is there wasn't new DNA evidence. It was just the prosecutor and the detective that was working on the case. That's where the DNA came from. Oopsie, Marcellus Williams is guilty. So the wife of the Lisha Gale's husband, which would be a widower, right? Is that what we say? His wife now is named Lori Friedman. And Lori's written in the Post-Dispatch several times about this case because, as she says each and every time, it's the fifth time now that this family tragedy has been revisited, relitigated, and reappeared in the press. She even wrote this in August. She said, "We're exhausted and exasperated," right? So what's going to happen tonight is there's closure. Because they don't have closure. And what she wrote in the Post in August really sums up this case. A well-to-do white woman stabbed to death in her upscale home by a black male perpetrator made Lisha's murder a headline-grabbing case from the beginning with racial, cultural, and social class components. Over the years, though, she wrote, this case has become a national and international news story, a foil for longstanding grievances, a platform for pundits, and a cause celeb for advocates and activists. All these ubiquitous but false statements only ignite partisan passions and cause endless anguish for my husband and Lisha's family. Mm. And she points toward, there was a press conference in Jeff City in August with exonerated former inmates proclaiming Williams' innocence. And it was this made-for-TV moment, but it was completely wrong because she cites a guy by the name of Kirk Bloodsworth, who was one of the exonerees on that day. And there was an op-ed in the Post that said, "I lived Marcellus Williams' story. Missouri must not let it end with his execution." And that piece exerted that, you know, the case had a lot of similarities, Kirk Bludgeworth and Marcellus Williams. But she wrote, "No, Mr. Bludgeworth, there are no similarities between your case and this one. You were an honorably discharged Marine. Marcellus Williams was a criminal with more than 16 convictions, including burglary, assault, armed criminal action, unlawful use of a weapon at the time of Lish's murder." They claim, Bludgeworth and others claim, two unreliable witnesses were incentivized by the prospect of reward money. This is false. One was Williams' girlfriend, who was never offered money in exchange for her testimony. She voluntarily testified anyway, and only after the trial was the decision made to split the reward money between the two witnesses. So that wasn't an incentive. He also said this: DNA testing exonerates him. Does not. We already went over that, right? The DNA testing was inconclusive, and the own expert witness testified that Williams himself could not be excluded from matching the DNA found on the knife. And by the way, the testimony at the trial revealed that he wore gloves during the commission of the crime, and in the affidavit filed with the court, Keith Larner, the prosecutor on the case, the original prosecutor, said the knife handle was not handled in a way that would preserve it for DNA testing. He said that police witnesses, as well as defense attorneys and jurors who were given access to the knife during deliberations, were able to touch it. It was also a kitchen knife from Lish Gale's home, which had been handled by numerous family members and guests. But the bottom line is that DNA evidence didn't do anything here because it wasn't valid, and it was the detective and the prosecutor's DNA. It was a bunch of nonsense, and they tried to lead people down a path. So her ask in the op-ed, and this is the ask for tonight, I think, as we say farewell to Marcellus Williams and put that needle in his arm that's well-deserved. He says, "I'm asking all of those who cling to unsupported claims of innocence, media outlets unable to resist sensational stories." That's you, the Post-Dispatch, where your own employee was brutally murdered. It's shameful that you've treated it this way. Pretend scientists speculating on DNA evidence and misinformed pundits to recognize that for the families of victims to consider that this is not about their beliefs, viewpoints, supposition, or speculation. For us, it is deeply and painfully personal. As I said then, this is not closure. This is chaos. Now, more than a quarter century later, the chaos has been compounded, and a grieving family still waits. Tonight is when that grieving family finally gets some closure with the needle in Marcellus Williams' arm, which is well-deserved and well overstated at this point. Should have happened 20 years ago. We're back in a moment. Audio cut of the day coming up here in just a few minutes before we wrap up on a Tuesday edition. We've talked a lot about the issue related to trans students on this show, mainly because I always refer to us as a bit of a ground zero when it came to Children's Hospital in WashU, and they shut that whole thing down because of Jamie Reed, the whistleblower, and because of attention from shows like this and some national attention as well. Oh, yeah. And then there was research in England that showed that all this stuff is kind of kooky anyway, and they shut their clinics down. So just as good that it happened here. But look, I'm a parent of a 9.5-year-old in fourth grade, and I am terrified by the prospect of pronouns and identifiers moving forward. Erica Sanzi is with us this afternoon. She is with the group Parents Defending Education, and they uncovered some things down in Springfield in the public schools that I think are pretty interesting. And she joins me this afternoon. Hi, Erica. How are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
I think a lot of us get worried about what's happening at school when we're not completely keeping, you know, an eye on things. And sometimes there's stuff that's going on with teachers and administration that's a bit of shenanigans these days. And that's kind of what you guys discovered here, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the gender policies have sort of exploded since around 2016. Most parents, myself included at the time, have no idea what's actually in these policies, especially because they're so beyond the pale that it's just not something that any of us could imagine. And so we started tracking what we call parental exclusion policies, and that means that the school has a written policy about gender that states that it will either encourages or requires staff to withhold information from parents if that's what the child wants.
So you know this now because you did a public records request, right, for the Springfield Public Schools, and they have actually, they have a document that is entitled Transgender Student Recommendations. And it says every student has the right to be addressed by a name and a pronoun that corresponds to the student's gender identity. It is recommended that school staff privately ask transgender students and their parents and guardians how they want to be addressed in class, in correspondence to the home, or at conferences with the student's parents, guardians. A student's legal name will be reflected in the student information system. So that's part of the document. But is there an encouragement within those where they say, hey, if you find this out, don't tell the parents?
Well, this is actually a strange policy because it actually seems contradictory. Because in one breath, they are rightly saying that they want parents or guardians to be part of this. But on the other hand, why would you need to discuss what you're going to call a child at a parent-teacher conference or in correspondence to the home if everybody's on the same page? Generally, when we see clauses about parent-teacher conferences and correspondence with the home, it's because they want to be sure that they don't reveal something about the child that the parents don't already know. And as I scrolled further down through the policies and through the documents, again, we see sort of more of these contradictions because it talks about what to do if the parents disagree with the child identifying as another gender. It talks about the counselor working with the students and the family to develop a plan that meets everyone's needs. But then in the end, it says that if the parents disagree, the district will continue to move forward with allowing students to identify as transgender at school. So on the one hand, again, Springfield gets a little bit of credit compared to some of these other districts in the sense that they seem to care about parental involvement and think that that's best. But it seems from the reading of this policy that, but if the kid says no, then they're willing to do one thing during the school day and something else in the presence of the parents.
So that's our
major concern with this.
Well, and it should be, absolutely. So there's one document that you got called Transgender Student Recommendation. There's another one that is called Student Pronouns Recommendation. So what does that say?
Oh, hang on one sec, because I don't even have it pulled up right in front of me.
That's all right. And I couldn't get it pulled up, so that's why I'm asking you. I should have downloaded this.
So wait a minute here. So I have the student pronouns recommendation policy specifically provides instructions for when parents disagree with their children identifying as another gender. And here it says, if the parent does not give consent for school staff to refer to the child by their name of choice or pronoun, the school counselor should work with students and family when appropriate. So you see how it says and family when appropriate.
Right.
To develop a plan that meets the needs of the student and family and fosters best educational outcomes. But it later explains in that document, as I stated before, that if the parents disagree, the district will continue to move forward with the transgender identity at school. So what they're really doing is they're trying to do two things at once that really can't happen at once. You can't agree to have the child be in charge and be the authority who gets to decide, and at the same time say, well, we're going to involve the parents and we want to know what the parents want us to do, because that's not always going to be the same.
Yeah.
And what they're stating is, they are stating that they are handing authority over to minor children without their parents' knowledge and knowing that they're doing it because the parents do not approve or consent.
Well, one question I think that I would have, Erica Sanzi is with us. She's the director of outreach at Parents Defending Education. We're talking about some things that are going on in Springfield public schools. The fact that you had to make, this is a public school district, that you had to actually submit a Freedom of Information request just to get this document seems ridiculous. I mean, this should be something, if it's their stated policy, they should be making that available to parents anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. And I have to assume that this wasn't public because my team member who submitted this request, I mean, why would they have done that if these were public? And there are a lot of school districts where they make them public. Some school districts now have started pulling them off their website because they get, you know, hassled rightfully for them. And instead they defer to the state. So they'll say, like in Massachusetts, we just follow the state guidelines. And then the state guidelines are, of course, to deliberately deceive parents across the board. And Springfield's not the only district near you guys that has this? Because I was looking earlier. Somebody else from the media reached out wanting to talk about this. And so I pulled up our Missouri list. Because what we do is we just put these policies up on our website. Primary sources, people can read them for themselves. You know, they can say, wow, this is great or this is terrible, but we're providing it. We have on our list for districts in Missouri that encourage or require staff to withhold information from parents on this issue. We have Hazelwood, Kansas City, Liberty, Melville, North Kansas City, St. Louis, and Springfield.
Yeah, and a couple of those districts are here in the St. Louis area. I mean, Melville, and I assume she said one other one that was from this area. And then we also had, look, we've had information that's come out in the last couple of years about my school district, Parkway, where there were emails that had been leaked where you could see that there were counselors and teachers that were clearly trying to hide things from parents and trying to manipulate the system so parents would not be discovering some of these things. So it's outrageous. But then what's a next step in something like this?
I mean, exposure is definitely the first thing. And as I was saying, like, I'm a parent that's really dialed into school issues, and I myself had no idea what was really in the policy that was passed in my district. Because if you don't, you know, sort of really dig deep and you're not looking carefully, like, they're not going to advertise the fact that they are going to be withholding information from parents and deliberately deceiving parents based on what the child directs them to do. Again, right, like the child is put in charge of this. So I think, you know, again, once you get parents aware of this, one thing I will say is usually most people don't believe it at first because it's so egregious and it feels like such a betrayal. And like people who've worked in schools, like I worked in schools for over 10 years, I would not have believed this if you had told me that schools were doing this. I wouldn't believe this unless I saw it with my own eyes. So one thing is just to get people aware, show it to them because they're not going to believe it. And then you hope that just a critical mass will begin to at least put some pressure on, again, do board members know what their policy is?
Well, that's a good
some
question too. Right. Absolutely.
Because oftentimes what we find is that local leaders have no idea what this, because again, these policies are copied and pasted, you know, minor tweaks here and there, but they come from activist groups. So when we look, whether it's I'm in Rhode Island, whether it's Massachusetts, Oregon, California, where you guys are, the wording is often almost identical because they're pulling from templates. And very often, the people running the school, the rank and file teachers often don't even know. And the other thing I would say, because I feel like teachers get a bad rap sometimes on this topic, so many rank and file teachers, if they do know about this, are appalled.
Yeah, I believe that.
They have a major level of discomfort. They do not. And they've said to me, one teacher said to me, and I quote, "I feel like I have to take an ethical shower every day when I get home from work." So they're being told that it's a requirement of their employment, and although they're not comfortable with it, I mean, of course you have some who are totally on board with this, and they think it's great, and this is their worldview, and they buy into this ideology. But in most cases, they don't like this.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. But this is a great resource for people. And by the way, the website is fantastic, Erica. All you have to do is go defendinged.org. And right there at the top of the page, it says indoctrination map. And you can open the map and you can look in Missouri. You'll see some things about Melville and some of the other districts and, you know, get involved and get active and get informed, I guess, is what I would say. Parents Defending Education. Erica, thank you so much for giving us that information this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take care. You know, Sue, I will say this, that it is one of my, like, I don't know how to handle that conversation with my daughter when pronouns and with all this trans stuff comes up. I don't know how to, I'm unprepared to deal with questions. Now, look, she knows my best friend is gay and has a partner. She's been dialed into that and has been fine. But this is another territory.
Yeah,
it really is.
It's different.
I don't exactly know. This is something interesting, too, and I probably won't have a lot of time right now, but and I want to find out more. All right. So my wife was telling me, I won't name names here, but Alexa had a little friend that was over the weekend. And they've been friends for years. And they, as friends do sometimes, you know, get into it and argue about the stuff. Well, apparently a couple of days ago, Trump came up and Harris came up. And this friend's mom is very liberal. Nothing wrong with that. But I'm just saying, she ain't on my side of politics. And I'm on the other side of politics. So you got Alexa, who I talk to. I don't you know, tell her
things.
I try to inform her and educate her, and she's watching Fox with me in the morning. I mean, I tend to turn it off when Hezbollah is bombing Israel and vice versa. But it was interesting because Becky had to lay the law down and said, nope, we're not talking politics. And this other little girl was like, yeah, but Trump said this and Trump said that. And, you know, then Alexa was trying to chime in, too.
Oh, my God.
Alexa's candidate, I'm just going to tell you who she loves. And she's still pissed off to this day that she's not the nominee. It's Nikki Haley. She loved Nikki Haley. She's
like,
why can't we put that other woman, the one with dark hair? I like her a lot. She loves Nikki Haley.
That's so funny.
Well, she didn't win the nomination. Yeah. But anyway, that's a dynamic, I think, kids arguing
that's
about politics.
It
is interesting. And I'm going to keep my eyes open and ears open on that one for sure. We have an audio cut of the day coming up here in just a minute. Hey, I'm going to Back to the Future, the musical tonight at the Fox. That should be fun. I don't know what to expect. A lot of these shows, you know, Sue, that come through, I've seen before. Maybe I've seen them on Broadway. This is not one that I've seen before. And I completely understand how they turned this into a stage play. And I've watched the trailer. But I'll be very curious to see the music and everything. I think they used the Huey Lewis music and stuff like that.
Oh, that's cool. Fred's going to be there with his neighbor, Joyce. As you know, the woman who buys shirts for Fred.
Is that his date tonight?
Yeah.
Oh, look at that. My date is 9.5-year-old Alexa Reardon. She's very much looking forward to it, especially since she has seen the movie. And we told Bob Gale that last week. Bob was phenomenal. He is the guy that created Back to the Future with Robert Zemeckis way back in the early 1980s. They met at film school at USC, and they just started talking. He was just dazzling last week.
He was awesome.
Now, here's what's interesting. So it was Back to the Future night at Busch Stadium last Monday when Bob was in town. He visited with us that afternoon. The notes that I have for tonight indicate that there will be a special appearance by Bob Gale. I'd have to think that that's going to be a hologram or a video because I don't think he's back in town, but I don't know. I don't know the information.
You're right. And remember, he said he was back here because he was going to his 50th, was it, or 60th, 55th reunion?
It was a big one.
At U City. So it's nice that the Cardinals timed it out for him.
I think it might have been 55th. Could that be possible?
I guess.
All right. I don't know.
I think you might be right. I don't know. But it was big.
Before I get to cut of the day here, Sue, are you going to go out tomorrow morning and get your Crocs, your Stomp Clops?
Why?
Because Crocs is releasing the tomorrow's Wednesday, Stomp Clog for Halloween. Get it Wednesday from the Addams Family.
I gotcha.
Now, this whole thing with, what do you call those stupid water bottles that everyone likes?
Oh, yeah. I can't think of it.
My daughter's got like 50 of them, right?
Yeah,
the Stanleys, right?
Two
things have caught me way off guard. The Stanleys, and then this whole Crocs thing. Because the other thing about both of those items is that there are accessories. Do you know that? Like, even in your Crocs, you can get these
little
things.
Charms and such.
I mean, from a marketing standpoint, from
it's
a revenue
genius,
standpoint,
Mark.
It is brilliant.
Genius.
I'm very, very disappointed that I didn't come up with that idea.
Yep.
But those things. I'm telling you, there's going to be, whether it's going to be, you know, a big asteroid that hits the planet, something's going to happen, right? And we're all going to be gone. This may be in 1,000 years, maybe in 2 million years. I don't know. But after a certain point, someone's going to rediscover this planet, and they're going to dig things up, and they're going to find bodies with these weird plastic shoes that have holes in them. And they're going to say, right then, this was not a very advanced society. You know how we know that? Because of the Crocs. I'm telling you, it's going to happen soon.
Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
I fight with my my daughter on this because she loves the Crocs. Okay, this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Kamala Harris said this earlier today, and it's gotten a little bit of attention.
I think we should eliminate the filibuster for Roe to actually put back in law the protections for reproductive freedom and for the ability of every person and every woman to make decisions about their own body and not have their government tell them what to do.
So it sounds good and everything, but she is getting blasted from a couple of former members of her caucus. They are more independents now. Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona and also Joe Manchin from West Virginia. The filibuster is a rule in the Senate that allows, you know, a smaller minority to block legislation pending a supermajority vote. So if you end it, it would make it, in theory, easier to pass laws related to abortion rights. But one of the things that Kyrsten Sinema reminded Kamala Harris of, she said, to state the supremely obvious, eliminating the filibuster to codify Roe v. Wade also enables a future Congress to ban all abortions nationwide. And Joe Manchin said basically the same thing. Hey, you're kind of dumb, but look, she's saying anything and everything that's going to get her elected right now. And that's what it's all about. Sue, have a great night.
Hey, you too. Have fun at the Fox.
I will. We'll be back at 3 tomorrow.
Get-
Get more at 971talk.com. Get more at 971talk.com.